The views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
One small step for man.
Easy,
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in with us this morning. First, a very hearty congratulations to SpaceX for a great flight, the Dragons going into the space station, and a terrific return. And for NASA, for all of their support with SpaceX and their work on the station and what they did to help make all of this come about. Everybody deserves a big, huge standing ovation and a lot of applause, and hopefully there'll be more successes like this to follow. And we hope Orbital joins in on the successes, too, as soon as they are able to do that. So for our program today, if you would like to call us, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. You can just wait until we answer the phone. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. We do answer the phone over the break, and we do hold you over the break. So if your timing is around the time of the break, don't worry about it. You will still get your call in. If you would like to simply email us, then the email address for today is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission, though, to download these programs. They are highly compressed MP3s, and you're able to share them and pass them around, help get the word out as to why space is important. A 90-minute program is approximately 40 megabytes. So that should be, give or take, the size of the file that you're going to work with. We also thank Andrew over at Gigadial. And he does our podcasting service for us, and you'll find the RSS URL for our podcasting on our website, both of our newsletters. Do let us know if you have any questions about podcasting. We're in iTunes and Microsoft Zune, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, and a host of other places. If you'd like us to be in still more places with podcasting, send your suggestion, and we will absolutely consider it and look into it. Do visit our website. It is thespaceshow.com. We have a comprehensive newsletter there on the front of our website. You can't possibly miss it. This is the website that has the guest bios and all the details of the week's programming. It is also the only place you will find a future events section for The Space Show. And when we have to make changes in our schedule, this is where you're going to find those changes first. So I would urge you to stay current with our programming by checking from time to time the website newsletter. Also on the website, you'll see an item called Guest Search. So if you go to this, you can do a global search for your favorite space word, let's just say microgravity, for example, or your favorite guest, let's say it's today's guest, Rex Ridenour, and you will get the dates for every program where microgravity was discussed and when Rex was on the program. And then just take those dates over to the Space Show archives and bring those programs up by date, and you will have them. And everything we have done, going back to the first ones in 2001, are all on our website. So you can easily download them, or you can just listen to them on the fly off of our website. There is a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top, Space Show Gear. Please do check it out. But above all, the big important button there is Support the Space Show. So again, I mean, not to beat a dead horse to death, but the Space Show is a nonprofit, and it requires funding to stay in business, to stay on the air, and to bring all of you free content. So we are a 501c3, so for those of you paying federal income taxes, you do get a deduction for your gift, and we're also a California Public Benefit Corporation, so the same holds true for those of you that are residents of California. This year we're doing thank you gifts. Our first one is at the $50 level, and you get a customized Space Show lapel pin. If you have any questions about our funding or making a gift to the Space Show, please check us out at thespaceshow.com or onegiantleapfoundation.org, or send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And finally, remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more info, visit secureworldfoundation.org. They are also the ones that have made possible our webinar series, and we are now in the planning stages for two webinars. Hopefully they will be able to take place in July, but I'll give you more information on that as it is known. And our guest today is Rex Ridenour, and we welcome him back. He's a space mission architect and space systems engineer by training and experience. And for the past 15 years, he's also been a space entrepreneur. For the first 20 years of his career at Hughes, Lockheed, Utah State, JPL, Microcosm, Space Dev, and Blastoff, Rex held a technical and leadership set of positions on 20 pathfinding leading-edge space missions and projects as a spacecraft systems engineer, test conductor, mission engineer, mission planner, mission architect, project engineer, and study leader. He was on the Viking Mars group. He was an undergraduate student intern back then. Some of the first shuttle missions. Following his interest and his passions, which are pretty diverse, and they go across all fields in the space industry, including Mars landings, outer planet exploration, and a lot more. He started in with Ecliptic, and you've heard us do lots of programs about this. They have, among all of the different products, these really cool cameras. Then you can see the pictures these cameras take on various NASA launches and other launches, where you see what's happening actually in space, not just off of the pad. And on June 1st, that's today, he is transitioning away from day-to-day operations at Ecliptic. He's going to continue on their board, and he is now consulting at the intersection of space technology, commercial space development, and the investor community. And that's what we're going to talk about today. But first, there are some good updates for Ecliptic. Welcome back to the program, Rex, and congratulations on your new course of action.
Yeah, thanks, David. Always nice to be on the show. It's a pretty exciting time.
Absolutely. So we checked just before the show, and you were on in December 2010.
Yes.
So a little bit more than a year. Actually, I guess a year and a half. What's new with Ecliptic? I assume a lot of things have changed, right?
Yeah, a lot of things are similar, but a lot of things have changed. What's similar is that for the entire 11 years of our business, since we started in 2001, our primary product family has been this Rocket Cam product family, which, as you said, is the series of products that provide onboard video for primarily rockets and spacecraft. Although I'll comment about that. We're starting to branch out there, too. But that's always been the vast majority of our business. It's still probably 95% of what we do. And last year, as a matter of fact, was our most active year with getting our systems launched. And we're all about delivering systems to rockets and spacecraft and other remote platforms that get fielded and launched. So last year was our busiest year ever. We had 18 systems launched, all related to space systems, rockets or spacecraft. And just to kind of recap, just for perspective on that, we were on the last year we were on the last three shuttle launches, and we've been on the external tank as well as the solid rocket boosters with all of those, and finished out the shuttle program. We were on probably the last two Delta IIs that Rocket Cam will have been on, and one of those launched the Aquarius mission and SAC-D mission and the other one launched both of the Grail spacecraft to the moon. So those Grail spacecraft were our second and third lunar missions after LCROSS, which we did in 2009. As the mission progressed, the Grail orbiters entered lunar orbit at the very end of this last year and January 1st this year. They entered a day apart, but we have a four-camera system on each one of those called MoonCam, which I'll talk about. Last year, we also were on a couple of classified spacecraft that even I don't know the name of, but those were very successful. We were on some Missile Defense Agency launches of boosters that launched targets up to space for testing our missile defense shield. We were on one of those again. That's probably our 12th or so that we've been on. We were on the several Atlas V launching, for example, the SBIRS GEO-1 mission up the geosynchronous orbit, the Juno mission to Jupiter, and Mars Science Laboratory to Mars. And then we also had some cool stuff on Minotaur 4 Lite, which is a version of the Minotaur rocket that Orbital Sciences builds, and they launched the second of the hypersonic test vehicles. It's a suborbital launch, but as you might imagine, a hypersonic test vehicle goes very fast across the sky, and I actually saw that thing zipping along after they separated, and it was a fast vehicle. And we had two new platforms that we'd never been on. One was a sounding rocket out of NASA Wallops, this rocket called Terrier Orion, and we were on an experiment there that was produced by NASA Goddard, captured live video during that. And then we also had our first experience ever on International Space Station. On the very last shuttle mission, this fairly large module called the Robotic Refueling Mission Demonstration module was launched on the shuttle, placed on the outside of the space station by spacewalking astronauts, and then quickly activated just to see if it worked, and it did. And then the real experiment started just a couple months ago, and I can talk about that later if you want. But that was our first experience getting our systems up on space stations. So in total, we had 18 systems launched. Fortunately, they all worked, and that keeps up our record. Now we're up to 108 systems that have been launched on either a rocket or a spacecraft, and we don't know of any failures of any of that equipment, so that's pretty exciting.
The pictures from the ISS of the Dragon taken with ISS cameras, the arm and all of that, is that your camera or is that something different?
No, they all of those video systems on the space station are there already from some other supplier, some other place. We have nothing to do with those. We also don't have anything, never have, on the shuttle orbiters themselves. As you know, there's a lot of good video from those, but we're strictly on the propulsion modules that take the orbiter up to space for shuttle.
And you're not, and SpaceX uses their own system, right?
Yeah, SpaceX's philosophy is to do everything in-house as much as possible, and that was one of the systems that they decided they would like to do in-house. And in fact, the guy who put most of that together originally used to work here at Ecliptic. But they have all that equipment of their own design.
So
it works great.
When we watched Mars Science Lab and we actually saw the separation in space head for Mars, that was your camera?
Yeah. And I would emphasize it's typically our video system. We like to supply a lot more than the cameras, and most of our business is not cameras per se, but it's the avionics that controls the cameras and manages the data. But yeah, for MSL, that view was from one of our cameras. Same thing with Grail. If you watch that separation from the Delta II, both of those spacecraft came off and were captured on video, and that was our system also.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, so that's been exciting. Kind of in parallel with all of that activity, which is all great, that's what we're all about, is getting stuff launched. We, over the last 2 years, have been able to transition all of our customers from an older, bigger, clunkier, and less capable avionics unit, which is about the size of a small shoebox, over to a new unit and a new design that's much, much smaller, more like the size of a fraction of a CubeSat, if you know what those are all about, those little cubical satellites that everybody's building. Our new avionics unit starts out at about 4 inches by 4 inches by about 3 inches, and that can control 8 cameras. 8 video cameras. We have one of those on the launch pad almost right now, ready to launch first one on a commercial satellite, and that'll watch antenna deployment. And all of our customers have transitioned over to that new avionics, which is much more capable, and we're going to see a lot of cool stuff out of those coming up, including last year, late in November, we shipped our first high-definition video system, which more and more customers are asking for. It's fairly difficult to get that all to work because the data rates are so high, but we finally managed to get it to work, and we're shipping a few more this quarter. We have already delivered some high-speed camera systems for watching parachute deployments from upcoming capsule tests, but those haven't been launched yet, of course. And we're well into being able to control on, we've done this on probably a dozen or 15 missions, we've controlled all sorts of infrared cameras for seeing more of a thermal signature rather than a video signature. So a lot of cool stuff.
Does Ecliptic is mostly about these space cameras and the getting the pictures back to Earth and control centers, right?
Yeah, what our one-liner description of what we do is we provide avionics and sensor systems for extreme environments. And primarily, so far, that's been for rockets and spacecraft. That's our passion, and that's what we're very dominant in. We're the world's leading supplier of that sort of equipment. But it's not really the cameras are the problem. It's the avionics and the data management is the real problem with all of that. That's the challenge. And so we're fundamentally more of an avionics and data handling and bandwidth management sort of provider and not a camera expert per se. If you want fancy science cameras, you go somewhere else. You don't come to us. We provide engineering quality and public relations quality video primarily. But the real challenge is not the cameras. It's getting those data flows managed on board and then down to the ground.
And how do you do that? Because I do just a simple 2-hour, mono webinar off of laptop, webcams, and the size of the files and the amount of data is unbelievable.
Right. And on the spacecraft and rockets, the bandwidth you're allowed to play with is much less typically than you can handle on your computer or with your, personal devices. And so typically what we do is you can rarely operate more than a few of these cameras at once before the data flows become more than you can manage. And so we, first and foremost, we control the on and off state of all the sensors that are on board. And we've been on systems as many as, some spacecraft carry as many as 16 cameras that we have to control. You can turn on one or two or three at a time, but that's it. Once they're on, they start generating lots of data compared to most of the rest of the data flows on board. So the first thing we do is if the data from the cameras, the video data, is not digitized already, and in many cases it isn't, first thing we do is digitize the video. And then once we digitize it, we can start compressing it. And in almost all cases, we compress the video frame by frame to knock the data rates down. In many cases, we throw frames away because some places, some users don't need 15 or 30 frames a second. They might be fine with a frame per second, or even a frame every 10 or 15 seconds. So one of the best ways to compress the data rate is just throw frames away and forget about them. And then once we have the data flow going, we are able to store fairly large amounts of that data as files in our avionics and just keep a hold of them, but not necessarily transmit them. We can then later transmit them at the right time when there's a path with a tracking station on the ground. With the compression, we can compress on the fly, what we call on the fly, which means it can vary up to what the customer wants or by command. So it's not a fixed compression rate. It's variable. We're able to do that based on events that are happening on board or mode changes happening on board these vehicles, which is often the case. Sometimes you can do a high data rate. Other times you have to knock it down and do a low data rate. So we do all of that inside this little bitty avionics unit and take care of all that complexity and keep it out of the flight computer that's on the rocket or a spacecraft. And most of our customers appreciate that simplicity of putting all this scheduling and all of the bandwidth management and all the control functions in a separate box that they just have to turn on and off and maybe tell it to go into one mode or the other. But otherwise, we take care of all that complexity. And then in about half of the missions we've been on, probably over 50, we've also taken care of the transmission from the platform down to the ground. We do that on Shuttle, Delta II, Minotaur. We supply the transmitter, the batteries, sometimes even for our own power. And so we typically provide a most of an entire system, not just the cameras. So once you get farther from the Earth, typically we're going through the spacecraft's own data handling system because we don't. It never pays to have a separate transmission system just for the video. But for low Earth orbit, we do it often ourselves.
Pretty amazing technology.
Yeah, and it's satisfying to see us all working, too. One thing that really keeps our business going is that, as you might appreciate, most of these customers are fairly conservative, and as long as you keep them happy, they don't like to change suppliers. And so for the life of the company, we're up to these missions now, 108 that we've been on, and that's typically what that pencils out to is about a launch every 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 4 to 8 weeks, depending on the year. But it's a fairly regular launch rate, and since we haven't really delivered a failure to these customers, they're not inclined to change.
What about on foreign launchers? Do you do anything with Ariane or any of the Russian or Chinese launchers?
No. We have never had a system launched on a foreign rocket or spacecraft. We delivered a system that was supposed to be on a human-rated balloon that was going to go up well into the stratosphere to the UK, but it actually never was fully launched up to that altitude. They tried to launch, but it was aborted because the balloon popped. But otherwise, we've only talked a little bit with Ariane and talked a teeny tiny bit with the Russians, but none of those organizations have ever really gotten serious about placing an order. If we did talk to the Chinese, we'd probably be thrown in jail, so we don't try.
Interesting.
All of our stuff is controlled under the ITAR regulations.
Is one kind of mission harder to do than another, or is it all using pretty much the same avionics now, and it's almost cookie cutter?
We would love for all of this to be fairly cookie cutter and repetitive, but in fact, most of the customers always want something a little different than what we just sold the other customers. But the architecture is staying fairly stable now. Our new avionics is modular in the sense that each new function that we add is sort of another slice of avionics, another little, third of an inch of avionics with a separate frame, separate mechanical frame. And once we have the functions identified the customer wants, we basically just produce and bolt all these different slices together and get them talking. But each customer typically wants a slightly different interface with their host platform, or they want a slightly different test program, which may mean some variations in how we put the thing together mechanically, or sometimes they want slightly different parts inside compared to the ones we would pick, and so we have to swap out a few parts to make them fit the quality assurance processes this company's used to. And so typically an order is about 80 or 90% similar to something we've done before, and then we make these minor changes and deliver something slightly new. What's more of a variable with how the project proceeds is the culture of the customer that we're dealing with. So if it's a human-rated program with NASA, they have much more severe and rigorous documentation requirements and analysis requirements and even sometimes test requirements. And all of that activity can easily add another 40, 50, or 60, or 80% to the overall scope of the job. If we're working sometimes with these fairly nimble commercial space companies, the new space companies we might call them, sometimes they don't really care much about the documentation except for the minimum required to interface with their vehicle. And those would be like what we call interface control documents. They always like to have an approved test procedure on how we're going to test these things before we deliver. So that's part of the package, and they also want the test data once we test, and we get that for them. But some of these customers, all they care about other than that is a decent kickoff meeting to make sure we're all on the same page and some weekly or monthly tag-ups by phone just to monitor the progress of the job. But since we have a very good reliability record, they basically say, we trust you to deliver the same quality system to us as you did all your other customers, and so go ahead and do that. And that can lead to a very, very capable but very cost-effective system because they're not too crazy about the documentation.
You have an email note from Chris in Salt Lake City, and he says, have you done or are you planning to do any systems with any of the suborbitals like Virgin or X-Core?
Yes, we already have a few systems that are being used on White Knight 2 and Spaceship 2 during the Virgin Galactic test program. Some of those are carryovers from the Spaceship 1 program, which all of Spaceship 2 and White Knight 2 derive from. And they're using some of the same systems that we used on Spaceship 1. We have some new systems on board that are high-definition video systems. So those were actually our first ones delivered, but they're not what we would call ready for a primary spacecraft or rocket application. These are more like for the internal fuselage views inside the cabin for the White Knight 2 and Spaceship 2. We've been talking with those folks for years about trying to help them do the flight operational flight vehicle systems, which have to be a different design, much more robust maintenance-wise and whatnot. So we're pursuing that. We early on in the test program for X-Core's Easy Rocket, which was one of their earlier versions of their rocket-powered plane. We had a system on those for a while. But right now we're just re-engaging for the Lynx vehicle, which is now maturing, and they're ready to talk. So those discussions will happen this year. We have not done anything with Armadillo, Masson, or Blue Origin, although we are talking occasionally with Blue Origin about stuff. That's a good question.
Interesting. What about Sierra Nevada?
Yeah, we're talking with Sierra Nevada. As you know, they just had their first captive carry test this week on Tuesday morning, I think it was. And they need to get over some basic hurdles of just getting ready for their flight test program before they get too serious about outfitting the vehicles with video systems, but we are talking with them. And we're fairly optimistic that eventually we'll be on that vehicle.
Do you have any competition to these systems other than what SpaceX does in-house?
Well, our biggest competition right now is our own customers that we would like to have, you know, like SpaceX. We'd love to have them as a customer, but they've decided they want to do it themselves, so that's happened a few other places as well. For the avionics that controls the sensors, there are a few other companies that can do similar things, but not exactly what we do. We believe that our system is much more capable for addressing the technical issues that you have on platforms, but there's other firms that provide fairly decent video compression cards, for example. There's other firms that provide fairly decent data handling cards, but we're not aware of any company that provides all the functions in one simple small avionics unit.
You know, it's pretty amazing. I was at a meeting yesterday morning at 8 o'clock, but I was able to, you know, watch on my iPhone, you know, the streaming images coming back from Dragon. And I also watched a lot of the stuff off of the Space Flight Now site on my iPhone because I wasn't home at the time.
I did exactly the same thing.
And it's amazing that it, and I'm on, what, in 3G. I wasn't even on a wireless system. And, you know, I could pick it up without a problem. I mean, I guess it's getting compressed even more as it's going across the 3G network.
Yeah, and the terrestrial systems and everything we have in our pocket is vastly superior to what we can put on these rockets and spacecraft right now. So, like, I carry a simple little camera in my pocket that is much smaller than a deck of cards. It's like as small as most cell phones, and it has a 14-megapixel sensor, and it does beautiful high-definition video and audio, you know, and data storage, all of that in that little package. And we have nothing close to that on a spacecraft yet.
So you can't put that camera on a spacecraft, something that small, and have it work?
Oh, yeah, we probably could, but that would be an experiment, and most of our customers probably would wonder what sort of parts are in that camera, because it could be that they're not very robust in the space radiation environment, but we don't know. But it'd be a great experiment to try. But the problem is, once you get that sort of data flowing, there aren't many spacecraft or rocket platforms that can handle that sort of data rate. We're struggling right now to match our platform's capability for just a 4-megapixel camera. And what's working there is a few frames per second is all we can do of video. And it swamps the data system.
Amazing.
So, yeah. So what's in your pocket is much better than what we can do right now. But, of course, everybody expects what's in their pocket to come down from space, you know, that sort of quality. So that's what we're shooting for is first go to some basic form of high definition, which is generally, you know, the first threshold for that is typically something called 720p. That's 720 lines per frame. Progressive scan video, and that's fairly decent high definition video, like you used to see about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago on the ground here. What most television sets have now is 1080p, which is, as you know, if you have one of those, it's spectacular.
That's what I have on my computer monitor, and it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah. So that's the goal, but we will never get there on a rocket or spacecraft live unless there's some dramatic improvement in the downlink back to the Earth. It'll have to be recorded and somehow returned back as a non-real-time saved file somehow.
So is there work being done to do something about the downlink constraints, or is that just a given?
I wouldn't be surprised since there's plenty of direct-to-home satellite broadcast, satellite TV broadcast satellites. That they certainly must be able to handle data rates like that with their primary channels, you know, for the service they're providing. But so far, none of those operators are willing to turn one of those channels over just for onboard cool video from the spacecraft. So we're always stuck living with sort of the auxiliary telemetry channel or something like that, which typically is a couple of orders less in magnitude and data rate capability.
So we'll get to your plans now that you're stepping down as being you know, the force behind everything at Ecliptic. Who's taking your place there, and what direction is the company going to pursue? Is it going to continue doing the same thing?
Well, yes and no. We have a pretty good lock on our market. You know, very good, strong position in the arena of onboard video systems for rockets and spacecraft. And a more general way to say that is situational awareness systems for rockets and spacecraft. So that's the buzzword in the community for systems that just provide awareness to all the stakeholders on what's really going on, and video is probably the best way to do that. And we're by far the leading supplier of that sort of thing. The problem with just focusing on that, though, is that there's only so many rocket launches per year, and there's only so many spacecraft on those rockets, so automatically our market's capped. And right now, for the last 11 years since we started, we've focused on the U.S. market, so we've capped ourselves even more by not really aggressively going after any foreign sales. But even if we did, that would only add maybe 50% to our total sales, and it's very difficult to get that 50%, so we hardly even try. So for several years, we've been trying to diversify into other areas where the other platforms in those areas need situational awareness, just like rockets and spacecraft do. And so there's a whole series of markets we have tried to poke our nose into, including probably the leading candidate is these unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. There's a whole bunch of those out there worldwide. There's commercial airliners are starting to put more and more video systems on board for both situational awareness and entertainment. Business jets and business aircraft do the same thing. There's homeland security applications where cities or borders or, you know, expensive facilities want more situational awareness around those places, and so they put lots of cameras in place, both visible and infrared, and tracking cameras and whatnot. There's all sorts of military vehicles and equipment, even soldier-worn equipment, and law enforcement equipment that uses video systems of all sorts and shapes and sizes. There are quite a few other missiles and rockets that are maybe used just for military purposes that are starting to use video. There's extreme test facilities like thermal vacuum chambers and large engine test stands and, airplane test stands for engines and whatnot that use video, and so on and so on. There's probably a dozen. Submarines and surface ships, everything to do with marine technology, even oil rigs, both above and below the surface of the water. All those systems or all those platforms out there still fit the definition of remote platforms in extreme environments. But what we've found is all of those areas have lots and lots of suppliers of what we do. And, not just a few, but, maybe a dozen or more. And so there's lots of entrenched suppliers. Since the volumes typically for those systems are much higher, they're building more of those things. The price per unit sold is quite a bit less than what we're used to because in the rocket and spacecraft business, volumes are really, really low. What we found is it's pretty hard to penetrate those other areas with what we have now. So we have made some progress in the unmanned aerial vehicle arena, and we are fielding some systems that are undergoing testing right now that seems to be working pretty well for supplying different sensor functions on an airplane, basically. So that's encouraging. And what we're trying to do is, as far as markets, we're trying to stay on top of our rocket and spacecraft market, continue to service that. I mentioned going to high definition. That's one of the priorities. Get better data handling, more robust software, that kind of thing. But we're also trying to make pushes into these other areas. And so what we've done at the company to manage all that is about a year ago, I must mention our company's only been at most 11 people. We started with 11. We're at 11 now. But in between the last 9 or 10 years, we've been typically down around 7, 8, or 9 people doing all this work. And two of us, myself and my chief financial officer, are relatively non-technical day-to-day. We don't do much of the technical work. Everybody else is doing the technical work. We've never had a secretary or a receptionist or any of those kind of functions. An accountant, accounting assistant. We've never had anybody but myself and my CFO doing the administrative side. So what we did about a year ago is my CFO, John Scully, was elevated to also be CEO. I was moved over to just strictly manage the space part of our business, which is still 90% of our business, as president of space programs. And then we elevated a guy that used to be our chief engineer to be vice president of marketing, primarily tasked with marketing into these new areas. And that's what he's taking the lead on. And then we elevated a guy that's been with us from day one, who is our director of production, responsible for getting all the hardware out the door and generally managing the technical part. He's now our chief engineer. And then we've hired 3 people in the last year. That's why we went from 8 to 11. And those people just basically fill in and start doing more of the technical work that, the other guy, our new VP of marketing, used to do. And get on top of some of these new areas. So we get a lot of work done with very few people, but we do expect to be hiring a few more by the end of the year as we start getting more contracts in the door.
You have an email question from Charles in Las Vegas, Charles Pooley. What are your data rates? What RF band do you use? And are you using an omnidirectional antenna?
Okay, the data rates that we can provide out of our avionics unit can go up to 100 megabits per second fairly easily. If we really pushed it, we could even go higher. But the trouble is, most of our platforms that we're on, rockets or spacecraft in particular, at best coming down to the ground on Earth, at best can supply single-digit megabits per second data rates, something like maybe 6 or 8 megabits per second. And so we have to cram a typical good channel of video, which can often be 20 megabits per second or so for a single channel video. We have to knock that down to more like, 8 or 6 or 5 or something, maybe 4. So that's where the bottleneck comes in with bandwidth. On most applications, we're transmitting an S-band, which is around 2200 megahertz, very common band for transmitting data like this from space.
You said S, like in SAM?
S is in SAM, yeah.
Okay.
But there's a nuance of the FCC regulations that if you're transmitting data that's more from an aircraft, and you're a commercial project, you have to go L-band, like L in Limo, Lima. And that's what we had to do on Spaceship One, and that's probably what Spaceship Two has to do, because they're a commercial program, and they're more like an aircraft than a spacecraft. And balloons have to do that also. There's a constraint also. If you're at the moon, there's some constraints on frequencies there, and occasionally you have to do X-band. And then the antennas we use are not typically omnidirectional. They're typically sort of low-gain or medium-gain antennas, depending on which mission you're on. And on the rockets, they're typically blade antennas, which are little, they look like a little blade, like a little wing that sticks out from the skin about an inch or so. And they're very thin, like a wing. They almost have a similar shape as a supersonic wing or something. And that's typical for a rocket. Sometimes for a spacecraft, it's more like a little dish sort of looking antenna that maybe looks more like a snow cone cup or an ice cream cone cup.
What are they made of?
Typically, they're some combination of plastic and metal, because there always has to be a conductor around those antennas. And the blade antennas are almost always kind of a metal, and the conical antennas typically are some sort of plastic or fiberglass frame, which is the cone shape, you know, wrapped with some sort of conductor, like a wire. But they're all pretty simple antennas. If a spacecraft is handling our video for us, like Grail at the moon, for example, they probably use much more capable antennas. That's a good question, though.
Interesting. We're coming up on the halfway point, so why don't we take a pause here, unless you want to say something more about ecliptic and where it's headed off into the future. Otherwise, we'll come back and hear about your new plans.
Yeah, well, let me talk about just what's coming up so people know what to look for.
Okay.
With our systems real quick here. We'll continue to be on several more Atlas Vs and Delta Fours. That's kind of a good base of business for us. We are on the almost on the launch pad now with Antares, the new rocket that Orbital Sciences has built, liquid-fueled rocket, to launch its Cygnus module to space station. We'll be on those launch vehicles. We're on the Cygnus module as well with a situational awareness video system to capture the views as it's coming towards space station. So that'll be pretty exciting. We should be on several more spacecraft going up to geosynchronous orbit to watch antenna deployments and solar ray deployments. I mentioned one of those is almost on the launch pad now. We expect to be, as I mentioned, continue to support the Spaceship Two program and some of these other new space companies like Sierra Nevada. We're hoping that will come through this year. We also have delivered hardware to support the Orion flight test program, the capsule that NASA is building for deep space human transport. We believe we are baselined on the Boeing capsule.
The CTS-100?
CTS-100. And we also have delivered quite a bit of hardware to some of these other commercial space companies, and we're just waiting for them to launch. So, and we'll continue to be on Missile Defense Agency target vehicles. We've got a lot of those coming up. So I still expect this year, 2012, to be a fairly active year for launches. Probably not as much as last year, but we'll be close. Maybe a dozen systems or 14, something like that. And what's exciting in the future as far as the viewer experience goes is we someday will have much more coming back in high definition, which will frankly be dramatically better than what we've been seeing, which is all standard video, NTSC.
Paul is in Reno, Nevada, and he has a quick question. Do you have any plans to be part of the Liberty vehicle, assuming it gets funded and developed?
I'd love to. We've already started talking with those folks. They have an interesting combination on the vehicle. It's a U.S.-built first stage, which is extremely similar to what we were on with the shuttle solid rocket boosters, as everybody knows.
Right.
So we're kind of the incumbent there. It's ours to lose. But the upper stage is all from the Ariane 5. Rocket over in Europe, and we've never been on that vehicle. They have their own video system that they use occasionally, not every time, but it comes from, I think, a Dutch company. And it'll be interesting to see how willing the program office is for that vehicle, which I assume was going to be built based here in the U.S. at ATK.
Right.
They'll have to make the decision, and they'll have to decide which one of those systems they want to use, because there's right now two different types. So we'd love to be on that vehicle if it gets funded.
Well, I hope you're the ones that they choose.
So do I.
Assuming the vehicle goes forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so why don't you take a breather and listeners take a pause, and we'll be back with Rex and more of his information and your questions. And again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program. Our guest today, Rex Ridenour. Rex, do you have a name for your new business services for you personally?
Yeah, I do, actually, and I'm actually pretty proud of it. And I've been telling people about it for the last month or so, and most people kind of like it. I frankly got a little tired over the last 11 years having to say my company name was Ecliptic Enterprises Corporation, and then also sometimes having to tell them what ecliptic meant, because a lot of people, it turns out, don't even know what that word means, unfortunately. And so I got kind of tired of that lengthy spiel every time I tried to explain who I work for. So my goal for my new, it'll be a limited liability company, or it is, an LLC. I wanted it to be really short, so I thought for quite a while about a really short name, and I finally came up with the name. It's spelled I-Z-U-P, as in Indigo Zebra Upsilon Paul, I-Z-U-P, and it's pronounced Eyes Up, as looking up to space. That's how it's pronounced. So it's Eyes Up LLC is my company name.
And it's a California LLC, right?
California, right. And it's just me right now. But I passed that around, especially last week at the International Space Development Conference in Washington, D.C. You know, at first, a lot of people don't quite know how to pronounce it, so on the back of my business card, I have in quotes, Eyes Up, and then they get it.
Do you have a website yet?
I do, but it's eyesupllc.com, but it's absolutely bare bones, and only says, it only gives my contact information and the one sentence summary of what I'm trying to do, which is what you read off at the beginning of this show.
Okay.
It is, I want to do some consulting in the intersection of space technology, commercial space development, and the investor community. And what I mean by that is it's clear if you just read the news every week that there's a broad array of mature space technologies across the board. All sorts of things have been proven now. And a lot of those technologies are being incorporated in all sorts of really exciting commercial space companies, like the ones we've just been talking about, you know, Virgin Galactic, SpaceX, so on and so on. And the third part of that isn't as obvious, but what I've been hearing the last several years, as more and more of these companies mature is that there are actually a lot of investors, especially in the U.S., that are starting to pay attention and starting to get what's going on. And they, quite a few of them apparently have their checkbooks out. And most of them that get in the press are the billionaires, like Jeff Bezos and Paul Allen and all these billionaires that are active supporting these companies. You know, the Google guys, all these billionaires that were behind the company Planetary Resources that announced last month. Those folks get the headlines. But there's a lot of other ones out there that have been off on the sidelines since the economy turned sour a few years ago. And a lot of those folks have parked their cash somewhere, and now they're ready to pull it out and put it somewhere. And some of those are interested in space, and especially the commercial space arena. So I was relatively busy the last several years at Ecliptic, but some of my friends that are working on the investor side kept suggesting that, boy, we could sure use someone with your technical background to help us work with these investors and try to explain to them what's going on and where they should put their money and why and what the risks are and how these companies all fit together and where they're all heading in the future and what could happen. And I would love to do that job because I do have a broad background, as you mentioned, and I feel like now I can finally put that to better use, maybe to help fuel this whole commercial space market by helping get more investment into it. And it's not my money, but I think I could help people with money make it smart money and put it in the right places and help advise them on what's going on. I think that'd be a really fun job, and so that's what I decided to do about. I really kind of thought about it 2 years ago, but I had a couple of constraints. One was the company here. I wanted to make sure that if I left and started out on my own that the company was healthy, and we had this big challenge, as I mentioned, of transitioning all of our customers from our older system to our newer system, and that was a pretty tough thing to do, and so it required a lot of my focus, and I didn't feel good about leaving right in the middle of that. I also, personally, I have two children, my wife and I do, and both of those were going off to college the last 2 years. One left 2 years ago, the other one's going this fall, and we didn't really want to make a big change like this until the kids were away at college. It just makes it a lot easier on everybody. So essentially when I decided to give notice here at Ecliptic was when I concluded that the company was healthy and it was a pretty good time to leave on a high note. And I also knew what my plans were for the kids going to college. And that all came together about March this year. So I gave notice near the end of March. And it's not notice in the sense that I'm leaving necessarily. What I'm actually doing is starting today under this Eyes Up LLC, is my very first client is Ecliptic, and I'm actually going to continue working with them on strategic planning, on business development, and on marketing at something like 20% of my time, maybe 30, depending on the month. But it's generally a non-real-time sort of interaction. I don't have to be here typically day-to-day or even for specific meetings, but it's more just moving things along in sort of my own pace, match with the company's desires, and kind of scheduling it myself and just coordinating with the guys a couple times a week to make sure we're all coordinated. But my goal was to not have to be here and be responsible day-to-day for things like I have been the last 11 years. And as you probably know, David, that's fun for a while, but after a while it becomes kind of a grind to have to keep paying attention to 50 things every single day and sometimes even the weekends over that span of time, and that's what I wanted to change.
You got a question on email. You ready for it?
Sure.
Pete in Memphis, Tennessee says, sorry, can't call David, listening at work. You know the Friday drill. Here's my question. I'd like to know what business or commercial opportunities Rex sees. Are they coming from the new space and the entrepreneurial community, or are these opportunities manifesting themselves more or less for traditional companies to pursue? What is the difference between what he wants to do and, say, an angel investment group like Space Angels Network? And how do you improve the business sense among the new space people? Because that's the area I know best, and I know that their business capabilities, as in their business plans and their understanding of business is really low and often confused with fantasy?
Good questions. The first part of that was, what opportunities do I see?
Yeah.
And my bias, if you will, and I've kind of thought this way ever since I started working in the business 34 years ago, space business, is that I'm much more inclined to promote and help mature commercial business models versus the typical government aerospace cost-plus sort of contracting model. I fortunately worked at Hughes Space and Communications the first 5 years of my career, which was a purely privately held commercial space company. And I saw how you could do things in that environment, and it was spectacular compared to the other mode. So I'm biased that way. I'm primarily pursuing opportunities in that area, as opposed, say, to a big aerospace prime trying to get another big contract from NASA. That's not my interest. But what I see that's really exciting, and it's about the most exciting time in my whole career, frankly, is that finally some of these aggressively commercial companies like SpaceX, like Bigelow Aerospace, like Virgin Galactic, are basically setting up their own vision and destiny for what they want to do and executing that. Primarily, it's their vision, it's their decision on what they want to do, and they're doing it. In some cases, like SpaceX, they're getting contracts from the government to help fund what they're doing, but in my mind, they're legitimate commercial contracts. The government's procuring these services commercially, but the companies are so far largely left to their own devices with a little oversight from NASA to do what they need to do. And as we saw last week, SpaceX did this quite well the first time through, with the trip up the space station and back. And so what I'm all about is promoting commercial companies that actually have a vision of their own of what they want to do and try to do what I can to make that happen and make them successful. In some cases, their customers might be NASA. In some cases, they might be foreign space agencies or foreign interests. In other cases, they might be other companies. But I think what's important is the commercial model of executing their business plan is what's really important, and setting their own destiny and controlling that as much as possible. I think the canonical example of where this could all lead is something like what Bigelow Aerospace wants to do with SpaceX and with commercial space transportation up to and from their modules. If you had a commercial module built by Bigelow up there that's doing whatever the commercial purpose is, doesn't really matter, and the commercial transportation is there to supply the crew back and forth, then you have essentially a component of the space program that has nothing really to do with the government except to get launch licenses and comply with treaties and things. But otherwise, there's not much government involvement there. And as we know from other markets, both on the ground and in the air and in the cyber world, once you let commercial interests start maturing and progressing on their own, lots of cool things happen. And I have a special passion for pushing these sorts of models all the way out to the moon and asteroids and Mars someday. And I see, you know, Elon Musk in particular is getting more and more vocal about his vision of having SpaceX directed at delivering humans to Mars someday and setting up civilization on Mars. And I love that vision. I like similar visions involving the moon and commercial activity at the moon, and I would like to work with any company that wants to do that. And I totally agree with the caller the emailer
question, yeah.
That what I have noticed also the last 30 years is that a lot of firms that claim they want to do this sort of thing don't really have a whole lot of business sense, and they don't really know much about business plans. And I've seen the last 5 years especially, that more and more of these companies actually do have some sort of sense anyway. Not all of them, but there's more coming out of the woodwork that actually do have a good business sense, and they're hiring people that do, and they're actually making good progress. You know, Virgin Galactic is exceedingly good at the business side, and I think SpaceX is getting pretty good at it too. And you can see evidence of that by just customers starting to buy their stuff. You know, Virgin just signed up their 500th passenger, paying passenger, and SpaceX has billions of dollars worth of backlog and they're getting commercial customers now, demanding commercial customers to schedule launches with their rockets. So I see all this stuff coming together, and we're transitioning from sort of a flaky phase to a more mature phase. And I see a lot of companies surviving over the next 5 years. I see a lot of them failing, too. But the fun thing is that I think there's going to be some really exciting commercial stuff happening by the end of this decade that's really going to revolutionize the space arena. And I just want to be part of it.
So you're not really looking to take on the startup that needs a lot of hand-holding and business understanding and stuff like that to write their first ever business plan. That's really not what you're doing, correct?
No, I kind of feel like I've been there, done that with Ecliptic, and it was interesting and fun most of the time, but I feel like I have more value to add by not focusing on any one given firm or digging back into the details of starting up one firm or maybe a couple of firms. But I'd rather kind of sit above all that and work with the folks that are monitoring this whole arena. And there are some groups that are forming that are keeping tabs of everything going on in this arena and trying to pass that information and filter it and interpret it for all of these institutions out there and all these individuals out there that want to invest or think they want to invest or want to insure. You know, there's insurers now that are paying attention to all this, because sooner or later all these companies are going to need insurance, you know, space insurance. And there's even regulatory issues that need to be worked. And there's standards that need to be set. And I think I could add more value in that at that level of detail rather than burying myself into one or few different companies. But that being said, you know, if an investor, say, has a short list of companies they'd like to invest in and they can get a hold of the business plans of those companies, I could certainly add some value reviewing those business plans and throwing in my 2 cents worth on what I think of their plans and maybe modifying them or suggesting modifications and be sort of an advisor. And so I intend to bring in some clients doing that sort of function as well.
So in terms of the other part of the question, how would you differentiate what you're doing from, say, Space Angels Network? Would you want to be doing due diligence for how they want to make an investment, or are you competitive with them?
Well, I believe that part of the Space Angels twist on things is that some of those folks actually have money to invest, or they know people that do.
Correct.
I'm not claiming I'm going to invest my own money right now, because I'm not of that ilk yet. But I do think I could add some value as some technical horsepower in that arena, in that discussion, helping all those folks decide where the right investments might be and what the risks are. And I'm bringing more of my technical background with my sensitivity to commercial business and proven track record, at least at Ecliptic, in knowing how to run a business profitably. And, you know, throw those discussions in the mix, because due diligence is a big part of all this. You know, whoever's going to be investing really ought to do some serious due diligence. And since some of those folks advising investors are asking me to help them, that's my cue that I think I have something to offer. And I also intend, I never have written much about my views on all of these things going on while I've been at Ecliptic, because it wasn't really part of Ecliptic scope, you know, and I'm the face of Ecliptic all these years. I haven't written much about what I think of all this, but I intend to do a little more writing maybe and submit some position papers, if you will, to places like Space Review online and get some of my opinions aired out there. Try to serve as a catalyst for some discussion and some action.
Tim is in Toronto, and he said if we loosely define space as human spaceflight and everything else, do you think most of your opportunity is everything else, or do you see commercial opportunities emerging in human spaceflight?
Yeah, I see opportunities in all areas pretty much. What typically gets the headlines lately is the human spaceflight angle, with the companies like Virgin Galactic and SpaceX talking about commercial crew and crews to Mars someday, what Bigelow Aerospace is doing. Those are all human spaceflight angles, even X-Corps. But there's equally interesting and compelling opportunities in the non-human space arena, like what Space Resources has just come out and had a fairly effective news release and press release about, press conference even. And that's all about the characterization and ultimate acquisition and utilization of solar system resources. I think that's a really key issue that needs to be discussed more and more. And I thought the press conference that Space Resources had for the first time really kind of put that issue on the table for discussion among non-space people in a fairly credible way, and it actually did get picked up pretty well by the media. And the point they were trying to make is, hey world, natural resources doesn't just mean what's on the Earth, it means what's in the solar system. And what's exciting to me is I've spent about a third of my career in the solar system exploration business when I was working at JPL, and coming up in 2015 will be basically the end of a, you know, decades-long process of exploring the solar system, and we will have visited and characterized essentially every planet and every major type of body in the solar system for the first time ever. And we kind of know what's out there now. We know generally where everything is to first order. We know generally what the variety of solar system bodies is all about. In many cases, we know quite a bit of detail about what's on those bodies and what's in those bodies. So the next question is, what do you do with all that information? And what I think you do with all of it is start doing what has been discussed for decades but never really been possible, and that is selectively go out and start acquiring that resource, whether it be water, water ice, you know, precious metals, whatever, regolith, and start growing the global economy and get the solar system into the global economy. That's one of the most exciting things I think the human species can ever do and needs to be done. And I think we're right at the threshold of that being turned on. I really want to be part of that, too.
Todd is in San Diego, and he says to grow the economy and to talk about space resources, and maybe given the kinds of businesses you're thinking about or opportunities, what are your thoughts on the need for property rights in space? I know that this has been a hot topic lately, especially since Rand put forth his ideas for land claims a couple of months ago.
Yeah, I think that's a really big issue. That, frankly, has been discussed as long as I've been going to space conferences, which is 1977. I went to the very first space conference I ever attended was the Space Industrialization Conference up in San Francisco, sponsored by the American Astronautical Society. And that topic was on the agenda at that conference as well. And it's been a topic at every International Astronautics Congress every year since then, if not before. And nothing new. I think the difference now is that there's going to be, in the next 5 years or so, there's going to be companies that can test that for the first time and actually try to do something and make a claim or push the dialogue so that some decisions have to be made. Before this, it's always been sort of academic. And I worked for Jim Benson as space dev in 1998 and 99 when he was trying to do a near-Earth asteroid prospecting mission. And he was very aggressive about trying to push the property rights issue, and his claim was going to be that after the near-Earth asteroid prospector mission was done, he was going to land on the asteroid that they're prospecting, which was Nereus, an asteroid called Nereus. We were going to land on the asteroid, and then he was going to claim the asteroid as space dev property just to push the discussion to a new level and see what happens.
Yeah, he got a lot of blowback. I remember sitting in conference sessions with Jim, and
right.
Boy, there were people whose buttons were pushed beyond what you can imagine.
Right, but I think in the next, you know, in this decade, some of this stuff is going to happen where either commercial companies or maybe even governments with commercial payloads on them are going to get back to the surface of the moon or get to an asteroid, and the world's going to have to face up to these issues. It's going to happen. So I think it's a very exciting thing that we finally can sort some of this out. But there are so many precedents on the Earth about how you go about claiming resources that we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. You know, the mining industry, the ocean exploration industry, surface of the bottom of the ocean, minerals industry, you know, all over the world, this has been figured out, and it's not rocket science. We can do it up in space, too.
Absolutely. Here is excuse me, Wendy is in Reno, Nevada. Are you in favor of one-way trips or quick trips to Mars, say, within the decade? Do you think that's going to be a possibility, and could there be a commercial value in doing that?
I think there's a sporting chance of something like that, and I assume she's talking about human trips to Mars.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah.
And I think there's a sporting chance of having that capability by the end of this decade. I'm more optimistic about, you know, the decade after. And Elon Musk has even said publicly recently that he intends to have that capability as early as 10 years, more likely 15 from now, and no later than 20 years. And I personally, I think I've said this on your last show too, David, that I personally think that is the absolute best way to start setting up shop at Mars, is to have one-way trips to Mars with humans. And the reason being is because I think they'll get no, if a company had that capability, and I think it almost has to be a company, because I can't imagine any government would ever endorse doing that under a government-funded program. But let's say it's a company like SpaceX. I think they would get no end of volunteers to go, talented volunteers who could easily handle the job. I would guess they could get thousands, if not tens of thousands, of volunteers if they open it up to world a world offering. And I think if people are willing to do it and they're willing to sign the waiver that, you know, they know they're going to die on Mars, but they're going to make headway while they're there, then if we can get the capability to continue to land similar vehicles on the surface of Mars in exactly the same place so that they're all within walking distance or roving distance, then that contingent of people can start setting up shop and set up the navigation systems, the landing systems, the propellant production systems, the communication systems, so that eventually when you want to do round trip trips, the infrastructure is there. At the International Space Development Conference last week, Buzz Aldrin stood up at the end of one of the QA sessions, and he outlined his vision for how to do this. And it was a little bit different. He said we should send humans first, and these could be governments as well as commercial humans, I suppose, sponsored humans, send them to Phobos and Deimos to set up telepresence operating stations at those orbiting moons above the surface of Mars. And then you start sending in an unmanned way, uncrewed way. You send payload after payload to the surface of Mars, where from the vantage point up above with telepresence, the crews up there can actually assemble all of this infrastructure from the orbit of Mars, not on the surface. And then you set up all these systems I just described robotically, basically, with telepresence, like we're doing with the space station now. And then, he said, then you start sending one-way trips to Mars, where the people that land basically are ready to just set up shop and live as citizens down there. And that's a different twist I hadn't heard before, but it makes sense also. And the reason you'd want to do that, I think, is because there has to be some commercial reason to do it. I think if it's a government rationale, it's never going to happen, just like Apollo never went anywhere. So the real question, and we have to sort this out over the next 5-10 years, is what's the commercial reason for doing that? And Jeff Grayson gave a keynote address one of the dinners at ISDC this last week from X-Corps. And last year his basic point when he gave a similar address was that the purpose of human space travel is settlement of the solar system. That was his basic point last year. The point this year was that if we don't settle the solar system for a fundamentally commercial reason, then it's not going to happen. And so the challenge to everybody was, let's figure out what it is we have in the solar system that's so valuable to the people back on Earth or between those people that are out there that it enables trade and can start actually generating an economy. And that's the real question. I don't claim I have the answer yet, but I'm sure water, ice, and water is part of that answer, because there's so much of it out there, and it has so many useful functions if you can just get more of it out there.
You know, I have had a lot of interviews with people doing various types of NASA academic studies or just simple academic studies, or they're associated with policy making at a very high level. And when they get asked about what are your thoughts on one-way trips to Mars, At least among the people that I've talked to, they universally oppose it, and they also state that they can't imagine that there would be any way to do it with any civilized government. They wouldn't allow it. And even if it were for private reasons or private people, with disclosure, that the government regulations wouldn't do it. And they say then that the industry itself would try to stop it because it would likely kill people probably en route to Mars, not even getting to Mars, and it would ruin the golden egg for everybody going to Mars down the road when the capability are making it at least more plausible and safer. So do you think that government regulations would step in and say, look, disclosure is not enough, you're not going to go do this?
Well, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if that's how it played out, but when you step back and think about it, that sort of attitude is quite insulting to our whole culture here in North America, because most Europeans that immigrated to the U.S. or to Canada, when they did that, they had almost no intention to go back, you know, and many of them died on the way over. And our entire continent was pretty much settled with that model.
Yeah, but we're long past that. Look at in New York, they want to stop you from having a 16-ounce Coke drink.
Yeah.
So talk about being insulting. I mean, whether it's good for you or not, that's not really the government's business, I guess.
Yeah, so, you know, most of the planet was settled in that mode from Africa on out. You know, tribes and peoples left with virtually no intention to go back to where they came from, and many of them died along the way. Even the Mormon Trail and the Santa Fe Trail, you know, it was littered with dead bodies all the way out. And somehow we've gotten risk-averse and have denied all of that heritage when we've gotten to the point we're at now. And it's kind of sad, but I think the only way to circumvent that attitude is that it has to go private again, just like most of those other people were back then. Those weren't government employees being sent over. They were private citizens voluntarily making the trip, sometimes paying their entire fortunes from wherever they came from to fund that trip. And unless it's sort of privatized again, it'll never happen again in space. But I wouldn't put it past governments to stop it no matter what, because that's the way governments work these days. But that would be a sad thing. But there is a glimmer of hope, since some commercial companies have a different vision than the governments, and they seem to have the technical capability. It's going to make for an interesting few decades coming up here.
Absolutely. And you know, as I say all the time, the government doesn't stop us from scuba diving or going to climb Mount Everest or,
right,
you know, whatever it is we want to do. Would they stop us or try to regulate, you know, going to Mars on a totally private, non-government-funded anything to do with the mission? I don't know. I would hope not.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I hope not. But
I really don't know.
But it, you know, especially in our country, which is famous for capitalism, when it starts sounding like socialism or dictatorialism, it's kind of ironic.
Absolutely. Where do you expect to be at the end of the first year of your business? Do you care to share some of your goals and timelines?
Yeah, sure. One thing I'm going to do this summer, which I've never done in my life since I was 12, I've never really taken any time off and eased up on the gas just to step back and think about things and not really be engaged actively with either school or summer jobs or vacations or what I call constrained time, you know, where I had to do something or be somewhere or be with someone. And I've had summer jobs ever since I was 12 and was active in gymnastics since I was 13 all the way through college. I had summer jobs every summer in college. I had things going on spring break every spring break in college. Had summer jobs I had work ever since I started working in the space biz. I've only been employed for basically about 3 weeks, and that was when I was setting up Ecliptic, so I was writing a business plan during that 3 weeks. And so I decided earlier this spring that one thing I want to do this summer between today and the time my kids both go to college in mid-August is I want to take a few days off or parts of weeks off and just step back and think about things. And so for the next 2.5 months, I'm basically going to just be working with Ecliptic at 20% time or 30% time. And then the rest of my time, I'm going to take sort of a mini sabbatical and just assess what's going on, read a lot, talk to a lot of people, have lunches with people, and try to sort out all this cool activity that's going on right now. And I'm also going to work on our house, which I've deferred chores on for about 15 years now since I left JTL. I really need to do some basic fix-up stuff on the house. And then after our kids go to college, I'm going to slowly start adding in clients based on what I decided over the summer, and one by one sort of add clients so that by the end of the year I'll probably be working full-time again for hopefully a really good mix of clients and projects, but not overwhelmingly so. And all through next year I intend to do pretty much the same thing, including supporting Ecliptic at some level. We haven't decided what yet, but whatever makes sense. And by the end of next year, end of 2013, I expect a lot of this commercial space activity will have kind of shaken out. Some companies will be soaring, other ones will probably crater. I think a lot of the Google Lunar X Prize teams will be closing down and not on the radar screen anymore, and just a few left. A lot of these partnerships and early demonstrations of technologies, launches, you know, first launches of things will have happened. And, you know, even in some cases, commercial operations will have already started. And at that time, I think I'll be prepared to decide whether I want to actually work for one company again or just continue on with what I was doing, which is this more general consulting in the whole arena. I haven't really decided which way I want to go there. But yeah. I think it's 18 months from today. I have to decide on my medical plan. That's one of the constraints. Is I'll be on COBRA until then, and I'll have to decide whether I want to get my own private medical plan or be under someone else's medical plan, and that might be a decision point to hire into a company or not.
Well, that might change based on what the Supreme Court does with Obamacare as well.
Yeah. So that's one of the issues, but that's a pretty big issue for me.
You might be on the federal plan, like it or not.
But it's premature to decide and pick a winner of all these interesting things going on. So I would be totally happy just monitoring it all and being a catalyst in this whole arena for a couple of years and then see what happens.
You're planning to remain in California?
Yes. I'm in Pasadena. I live 2 miles from Ecliptic, so it's very easy for me to come and go, check in on things here, and we've decided we're just going to stay put for about 4 years until our youngest is out of college.
Are they going into space fields or aerospace engineering?
No, unfortunately not. One's an accomplished artist and a gymnast in college. The other one is good at everything, and she's going to decide at the end of her freshman year what she wants to do, but it'll be some interdisciplinary major that involves probably mostly the sciences or the humanities and then a little bit of science and technology. But the science and technology might be just a minor, not a major.
But they're not going to go into the space-related fields,
no,
per se.
No. All they saw me do at Ecliptic was sit in meetings and have meetings and talk. And they said, that's boring.
Well, didn't they go to launches and see a lot of the cool stuff?
Yeah, well, they saw Spaceship One do the X-Prize flight.
Uh-huh.
But they were pretty young at the time, and it didn't make a big enough impact on them. They appreciate what I do, but I don't think they want to do it.
Pretty interesting. Do you is with the space tourism industry, you know, hopefully finally emerging and actually getting underway, and you're the expert in these systems, is there any way that the tourist could have an affordable camera system to point out the window and take his or her own pictures and send it down to somebody on the ground that's receiving his signal? I mean, is there any way this could be personalized?
The camera certainly could be almost what everybody carries in their pocket now.
Well, it could be on your iPhone for all that matter, right?
The camera itself could be what we carry in our pocket. But the problem, again, is the data rate coming out of those cameras. Let's say you have 6 passengers on Virgin Galactic Spaceship Two, and they all have their iPhones going at once, you know, cranking out high definition video. The problem is, how do you cram all that video into some sort of a downlink back to the Earth? Let's say privately, but for their families on the ground, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know of any link system right now that you could do that on, given the changing geometry and the changing trajectory of the spaceship as it goes up and down, unless it was some sort of optical communications link, because that's a huge data rate. So even if Virgin Galactic wanted to take care of the downlink on their own nickel on their spaceship, you know, with some common system, I don't think they could do it unless it was a very high-power radio link or some sort of optical communications link, and I don't think they're going to do either one.
Could you provide wireless in the spaceship up, even on all the way up to, you know, the height of where you're going, 62 miles? Could you do that and maintain, like, just a high-end, high-speed T1 line or something coming back?
I imagine you could. I think it would take a pretty good steerable dish antenna on the ground, but I'm sure you could. You know, it's just a matter of antennas and power and whatnot. But I think what's more likely to happen for the passengers is the spaceship itself may be downlinking one or two channels of video. Maybe one of those will be high definition, or a couple maybe. But I believe those will come down privately so that they're not generally available to the public. But it's more for the satisfaction of the family members and stakeholders on the ground.
So they can log on to a special private
URL.
Maybe
in the spaceport only. You know, maybe the New Mexico spaceport, if it's Virgin. You know, maybe it's only the people that are in the spaceport building itself can see that video link. And then I think what else is going to be happening in parallel with that is, if the passengers are taking video, they'll store them on their little SD drives, you know, their little memory sticks in their camera, for later transfer to some other system for editing and processing. Or it's possible they might just store all of that video on board some sort of a server that's buried in the, you know, the bowels of the ship somewhere that stores all of that data for everybody. You know, it could be, I haven't heard one way or the other, it could be that Virgin will say, we don't want anybody holding their own camera. We're going to take care of the video for you with cameras that are fixed inside the cabin. You know, they may not want a camera loose floating around in case it gets out. And I don't know which way they're going to go, but I know I've heard in public conferences that Virgin claims they will make sure that every passenger gets that experience recorded on video and audio as completely as they've ever had anything recorded in their entire lives, because it'll be a key moment of their entire lives. So they assured everybody they're going to make sure that they will have rich video coverage and audio coverage of everything that happens, from the time they show up for the flight until they're down on the ground and taking a shower, probably. You know?
So rather than having personal live streaming from all the passengers, it's probably going to be more or less collective and stored and then available.
I think so, because I have heard from several of these suppliers, you know, the service providers,
uh-huh,
who are going to provide these trips, that it's not in their best interest to market their experience to have all of these personal videos on YouTube after every flight, because then future passengers, if they kind of cheat and look ahead and look at those videos, it takes a little bit of the drama and the surprise from the experience away. So it's going to be more like Disney does when you're going to a new attraction at Disney. They have you wind through this long line to get to the front of the line.
Right.
But while you're doing it, you don't see a whole lot about the ride. You just get little teasers and glimpses, but you don't see the whole ride ahead of time. You know, they keep that sort of secret until you go into the magic door and sit down. You know, Star Wars is a perfect example if you've ever been to the Star Wars ride.
Uh-huh.
You get all this cool, you know, they get you in the mood and you feel like you're in a space station and a launch facility, but you never see the ride until you're in the door, in the mobile platform that you're in. I think it's great. It'll be something like that, I think.
Do listeners have a way to contact you, given your new business plans, if they want to, or should I have them go through me and filter for you?
They're welcome to email me. My Ecliptic address is still good, and it will be probably for a couple years, because I'm still on the board and still active. And that's rideanhour@eclipticenterprises.com. And my last name is spelled R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R-E. My non-ecliptic address is just rexridenauer@gmail.com for now. Soon it'll probably be at isupllc.com. But it's rexridenauer, all one word.
Okay. What should we have talked about that we've missed or forgotten or that you want to be sure to say?
Well, I would reiterate, it's a little bit like what I touched on before, but I want to say it one more time, and that is that the reason this is the most exciting time for me in my whole career, and it should be the most exciting time for most humans on the planet, if they think about it, is that for the first time in our human species, and the only time in our human species history, whatever that turns out to be, for the first time we have a convergence where we have initially explored the solar system. We kind of know what's out there. We kind of know how it all works. And we've got some great questions to answer, like where exactly is the water and where might life actually be out there. But we kind of know what's out there. And by 2015, we will essentially have checked all the boxes for the first time after we land on a comet, which is coming up after we pass by Pluto with the New Horizons spacecraft. Those are the last two big boxes to check. So here we are. We've got all this information for the very first time. We kind of know where it all works, how it all works. And at the same time, we have the capability as humans to get off the planet and actually go to many of these interesting places, both in a government-funded way and very soon a commercial way, private way, and actually go figure out what we want to do out there. And we can do it with robotics, we can do it with humans, we can do it with both, and it'll be both. And to me, that's extremely exciting. We're poised to start utilizing the solar system to grow the world economy and float the boat of everybody on the planet by getting more resources into the equation. You know, we're not limited by resources, we're just limited by access. And we can float everybody's boat by getting out there and starting to utilize what's out there. And at the same time, we can enable the multi-planet species model, where we get people living on other places besides just the Earth. Which, if you're interested in keeping the human species alive, that's a good thing to do. And so to me, it's just like terribly exciting that we're at that point, and it's all happened in our lifetime. If you're like our age, David, you know, we've seen all this from day one when they launched Sputnik in 57 all the way till now, and here we are. And the next 50 years are going to be much more exciting than the first 50.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Of course, I doubt I'll be here for 50 more years, but... Yeah. One never knows.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna try to gut it out until as long as possible to see what's happening.
Well, you're still a young guy, so.
Yeah, but it's just a terrific convergence of two things that just change the equation for almost everything we worry about on Earth, and that's why my company's named Eyes Up. If we just look up, all the solutions are out there. We just have to make them happen.
A good closing comment for our show today.
Well, thank you. And pleasure to be on your show. I guess I'll have to tag up with you next year sometime and see how things are playing out.
Well, I'll see you at the New Space Conference if you're there, and probably the big AIAA conference is back in Pasadena this year.
It's in Pasadena this year.
Yeah, so I'll be at both of them, and I'll see you at both of them.
Very good.
And best of luck, and keep me posted, and I'll look forward to your next visit with more and more updates on the program.
Looking forward to it, and thanks for all the listeners for listening in and emailing questions and paying attention.
And thank you for all of what you're doing and all of those great views that you have brought to so many of us over these various launches for years and years. And listeners, that's it. So on behalf of Rex, as well as myself and the Space Show, thanks for listening. Our guest on Sunday is Jim Muncy. We'll be talking space policy and more, so you don't want to miss that program. And everybody have a great, safe weekend. Thanks for listening to today's Space Show. Goodbye.